Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The 1950s have been called the golden age of television advertising. Marketing and the medium were growing up together, and St. Louis was right in the middle of it. Major ad agencies were headquartered here, doing their marketing best to sell a wide variety of products and concepts. The Missouri History Museum is putting together an historic film collection that includes TV ads from the 50s and beyond. Joining me in studio to talk about it is Chris Martinez, the manager of media archives and digital assets at the Missouri History Museum. Chris, nice to have you back. Thanks, Don.
It's great to be here.
This is one heck of a gigantic undertaking from what I'm led to understand.
It certainly is. It's a very large collection. The collection itself is comprised of film, audio materials, and production records that the Missouri History Museum purchased. And it spans the era of 1950s to the 1990s. The film portion that we're focusing on is from the 1950s to the late 70s and is comprised of approximately 5,600 films.
56. How did you preserve this film? I mean, we're going back 60-plus years, and film is fragile.
It is very fragile. The first thing is to really get it stored properly. So being that it is organic, so it does decay just like anything else and quite rapidly. So fortunately, the Missouri History Museum was wise enough to send the materials off to underground vaults and storage in Kansas City, the old salt mines, in which the conditions are ideal for film storage. So by keeping it cool and dry, we can extend the life of this material. The other thing is to treat the film properly, to make sure that it's wound properly on a spool and that it's not in metal, around metal, and that the cans are vented because the base of the film is acetate and it creates acetic acid. You'll know acetic acid. You've got a bottle of Tabasco sauce. It's got acetic acid and it's vinegar. So that's why sometimes film smells like vinegar, is as it decays, it produces acetic acid. So that acid needs to be vented out. Otherwise, it will contribute to the decay of the film. So that's the other part, is housing it properly and then conditioning it. So that's what the preservationists will be doing over the next 3 years, is that they will be treating the film by putting what we call fresh leader. It's blank film so that they don't have to actually touch the image, and then also conditioning it with conditioners, cleaning all the dust and debris. The oil from projectors is also on the film. So you clean all of that off, and with a lubricant kind of conditioner that keeps the film flexible, and then we wind it tightly on a spool so that it doesn't bend or buckle. And then we house it in vented canisters.
Somebody had some tremendous vision a way back when to preserve this. I think of all the old the vintage television shows from the 50s. The kinescope recordings were lost. They were just tossed away. Local television stations lost their film because they didn't think to preserve it the way someone has with your video.
That's very true. Often this material was considered ephemeral. Production houses, they produced it for the term that they needed it for, and then thought no one else might be interested in it, or they had to move on to other things. Again, the cost of preserving it, storing it, can be quite expensive, and it just may not be within a budget of a production house or a television station to keep this. And they move on to another format, and they consider it obsolete.
But ultimately, you're going to digitize it. You're going to have to, aren't you?
That is correct, and that's part of what we're doing. So the other part of this project is to catalog the material, research the project folders, research the projects themselves, the content, describe it, do condition reports about how far it's decayed, and then from there we can generate or devise a digitization plan by priority, meaning what's important, how far is it decayed, what's the urgency of this, and also by importance of content.
What are you going to do with it? Is it going to be archived once again in some form, or is it going to be put on display, some sort of an exhibit?
Yes. So part of this project, periodically as we continue to catalog it, the records themselves, meaning the information about the film, is available to the public. So anyone going to our website can look up this material and discover this material and request it. Now, requesting it can be a bit tricky because, as you know, some things are copywritten and it's very layered. So it can't be used for everything. However, it can be accessed. For researchers, can come in and they can look for the material, find out information about it, look at the campaigns, find out information about that, and look at the film, and sometimes possibly be able to utilize it.
You're early on in this whole process, but what have you learned? What has struck you about what you've seen so far?
Well, part of it is the amazing content, how vast and diverse it was. St. Louis, as you might know, was an advertising hub in the 1950s. There were many large advertising houses, and Premier Films was crucial in that. What they did was they actually produced the films that were used in the advertising campaign. So they worked for many of the advertising houses and produced these films, and it was very diverse. In addition to advertising, they did industrial films, meaning films that were used by corporations internally or to share with other corporations as well, meaning social campaigns, things like that, not necessarily commercial productions. So the content is very rich in its diversity, and it also gives you a snapshot of a time and a period, how people thought, how they dressed, what they talked about, how they spoke. It's very informative, and I consider it very rich material.
Boy, when I think back in some of those firms at Darcy, Gardner Advertising, Batts Hudson, and New Werner, Fleischmann, Hillard, Ed, and marketing firms, we were right in the middle of all this stuff, weren't we?
We certainly were. It was a very, very, very rich time, I think.
Well, some of the stuff, as we have indicated earlier before going on the air, some of it, the film may be holding up well, but sometimes the commercials don't quite so. Let's listen to one or two as that time marches on. I think the first one we have is for Old Judge Coffee. Sure. That was a local firm, produced locally. Anything you want to tell us about that before we hear it?
Well, I think this clip was actually used in one of our exhibits when we had the coffee exhibit. And yes, Old Judge was a very large company producing coffee, and some of the campaigns are quite humorous, of course, but
unintentionally humorous.
Unintentionally, yes. Yeah. I think that they really wanted to do was really catch the audience's attention, and so there's various films in this campaign, and I believe the one is South American Girls. It might be, and it's really talking about South American blends of coffee, and that's pretty much it.
That's the one. Let's give a listen.
Hello. In the countries we come from, they grow many fine coffees, but only the best is for Old Judge Coffee.
Folks, that's true in all the countries of Central and South America, where the finest coffees in the world are grown. Look for the display of Old Judge Coffee at your grocer's. All Old Judge is irradiated for an extra flavor boost, vacuum-packed for freshness, and comes in all three popular grinds, fine, regular, and drip. For good coffee, don't try magic. Try quality. Enjoy Old Judge Coffee.
Well, you know, I get a kick out of the announcers. The announcers of that day all sound the same. Maybe it's the same guy. I don't know.
Right, right. Yeah. Often it was, yes.
And sitting down to a cup of nicely irradiated coffee doesn't sound that appealing to me today.
Well, you know, that's very interesting because it does talk about a time. You know, we're talking about the nuclear age, right? We're talking about the space age. Very interested in science, and irradiating it really suggests something very advanced and scientific.
And this is part of, I know, having heard earlier discussions with you, that this is something that really fascinates you, looking back in time this way, the clothes people wore, the way they spoke, and that sort of thing.
Certainly, and the ideas as well. And it's interesting to see how things change, but also how they come back around again. Often you'll see that. History does repeat itself, and fads come back, styles come back, ideas come back around too.
Hmm. Well, for instance, give me some ideas.
Well, I think sort of like this idea of irradiation or, you know, using science or something advanced to suggest something. Now it's technology, a lot of technology and making people feel like they're a part of the cutting edge or into the future, right? Welcome to the future. Here we are. You know, you could be a part of something, the newest thing.
When you've had all of this organized, how are people going to be able to see it? You mentioned going online, but certainly they're going to have an opportunity to do that at the museum, aren't they?
That is true. So, of course, we regularly do exhibits. This content may be used in an exhibit. You can certainly find it online eventually. We will be periodically digitizing materials from the collection as we move forward over the next 3 years. So anything that we find that's significant or we think is important, we'll be putting online. I will, of course, be writing about it, so we'll do regular blogs about it. But in addition, researchers can come, and if they find the material, they can request it. They can request to see it, and we will be digitizing on demand as well. So if it's something that you may be interested in, you can make requests, And we can either digitize it, or if it's available, you can we can make it available to see.
What was the genesis of this of this idea? Aside from the fact that you knew that in Kansas City and the salt caves, you had this video.
Well, I think it was the content itself. Yeah. We consider it a very important collection, and so we applied for a grant for IMLS, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and they thought it was important as well. So it is about really the importance of the material, the historic importance, and the importance of the content and what it might provide for the public. It has to be considered very important to the public, and I think we think it's important. And so that was really part of the idea.
What are some of the changes you've seen in these commercials? You say you're going all the way up to the 90s, from the 50s to the 90s. How do you see them evolving?
Well, in particular about the content and what they're talking about and the products themselves, you know, TV is really driven by advertising. So it really relates to what the creators of the content what the advertisers want. What you'll see is that even the shows themselves are really geared towards what someone wants to present to an audience. So what you see is how ideas and social values might even change as well. This particular collection goes up to the 70s. So I think the stuff in the 90s was really more audio, meaning radio advertisements. But up through the 70s, you could see how fads change, dress changes, music, social ideas, really.
Any particular insight into St. Louis through what you've seen so far? I mean, these ads would show nationally trends and that sort of thing. What about locally? Anything come to mind?
Well, that's a tough one. I think only in the sense that companies come and go. You know, or you see a company grow, you'll see that it becomes more prominent and you'll see it being advertised more, focused on. But, you know, I think that we had some very important institutions in St. Louis that were really focused on. For instance, the American Cancer Society, Brown Shoe Company. Brown Shoe was around for a long time. It's no longer in St. Louis.
Oh, it's now Caleres. Same company, different name.
Right. They get bought out. So yeah. Things change. So, you notice that things develop. They get changed. United Way. American Red Cross, Washington University Medical Center. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that medicine changes, how Washington University has become so prominent in the medical world, and how Premier Films was producing content for them as well. So, it really develops, and it's very interesting that many of these large institutions are in St. Louis or were in St. Louis.
We'll come back in a moment. I have to take a break and listen to some more. But one of the things we have to point out is that the television advertising and television itself are both coming of age at the same time. They're both trying to figure it all out and how it would work and how to make it work.
Yes, that's very true.
It's pretty clear. Come back and listen to some more in just a moment or two. We're talking with Chris Martinez of the Missouri History Museum. We're talking about vintage television commercials and a huge exhibit and a collection that Chris is helping to collate even as we speak. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we are back with Chris Martinez of the Missouri History Museum to talk about vintage television commercials. And Chris, let's start right away with another one. It's a company that I guess was prominent in the Springfield, Illinois area rather than St. Louis. This is a beer commercial. Beer commercials played a big role in early television.
Oh, certainly. And this was a big one. Reich Beer at one point claimed to be the oldest family owned and operated brewer in the country. They began in 1849 and dissolved in 1966. Reich Beer, this particular commercial was produced for Reich Beer and for the Oakley R. French and Associates Advertising Company in 1957.
That's early on. Let's give a listen to the Reich Beer commercial.
Reich Beer. Reich beer, Reich for over 100 years, famous for the finest beer, wonderful flavor and golden clear. When you serve Reich, your guests will cheer. Reich beer, good beer.
Well, that's Reichsbier. The commercial was interesting, but not good enough to keep the company in business, obviously.
That's true. It was quite competitive, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, Reichsbier. And what we have here is a jingle. Do you find a lot of jingles emerging during the early days?
You do. And that I think that was very important. You know, I think a lot of this, a lot of traditions in television came out of radio. And I think jingles, of course, were an important part of that. And, of course, I'm sure the radio audience now will have that tune stuck in their head. And I think that was the idea, was to get it in their head and make the association and make people think about Reichsbier.
And still very much a part of the advertising process today. I mean, that's key.
It is. And, of course, music has changed a lot since then.
You have also, as part of your collection, storyboards and various notes that were taken at the same time. What is their relevance to the production of these commercials?
Well, we're really fortunate to have that material. It's not always the case that we can have the documents associated with a moving image and sound collection. What's important about those is it gives us insight as to the campaigns themselves, when they were produced, who they were produced for, and also what the content is. Film has many elements to it, and it has to go through many processes of printing and review and then distribution. And often these folders will contain those materials. Everything from storyboards written on the back of an envelope to telegrams ordering various prints or approval of prints, things like that. So reviewing the documents and associating it will really give the preservationist some insight and information in thoroughly cataloging the material. And again, as much as we can, that material will be available to the public to learn about these collections.
If they're writing instructions on the backs of envelopes, it sounds to me like maybe some of these things were produced like flying by the seat of your pants, just to make it up as you go along.
Oh, certainly. You know, that's the creative process. Yeah. You know, we have an idea, we have a concept, let's work this out. And, you know, sometimes it's in meetings, sometimes it's someone just getting an idea and putting it down and then developing that idea into something that is successful.
Are you going to be able to do anything about the sound? The sound quality is certainly not what we're used to today. And it sounds like it has deteriorated somewhat as well.
That's true. So we can in certain instances. So, of course, if something has degraded to a certain extent, it's very difficult, but we are fortunate to have a lot of tools in digitization now that help us remediate some of those issues with color, with scratching. Now, that's restoration, of course, but also with audio in the sense of making the audio cleaner and clearer, and we have some very good equipment to help us do that.
Has there been any of it you've just had to throw away that it's not salvageable?
There has been in the past. I have not had to do that, but you know, certainly as technology moves along, we are better capable of remediating this material. But unfortunately, in the past, they were not able to do that, and we have lost some considerable content, yes.
How many people do you have working on this?
So we will have two preservationists working for 3 years on this project exclusively.
Wow. 3 years.
Full-time,
and
yes.
That's right, every day.
That's correct.
Five days a week. Where does the money come from to finance this project?
So it came from IMLS, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and they gave us money to do that, and then, of course, we have to contribute some as well.
Is this sort of thing going on in other museums and other parts of the country, do you think?
It is going on all over the world. Media archivists all over the world trying to save this content. And it's not just advertising film. It's home movies. It's films of various sorts.
And you mentioned industrial films being a part of this as well. Do you have a great many of those?
We do. I don't know what percentage we have, but of course that will be part of the discovery process in doing this. And I think that's what's partly exciting about the whole project is the discovery process is going through this and discovering materials and learning about the industry, learning about Premiere Films and learning about the corporations that I mentioned earlier and finding out what they were doing and what their plans were and really learning about the time itself.
Do you have any idea, Chris, as to how many commercials, for instance, that you do have available to you?
You know, I really don't. I think, again, that will be part of the discovery process. But out of 5,600 films, it's various formats, 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter. So I'm certain that probably a good portion of that will be advertising.
I was surprised that that some were done in 35 millimeter. I mean, that's what you use for movies. And television back in the day was using 16 millimeter film.
It's true. It depends on the company. You know, it depends on how much they want to invest in the material. 35 millimeter film, and you may have a clip from a 35 millimeter film that we have that was produced for Budweiser by Premier Films. And it was really it was the internal sales film. So this was something that would be distributed to the sales people across the country for Budweiser. But it also may have been presented at the Brewers Convention, which actually happened here in 1966. Mm-hmm. So I think they invested a lot of money in trying to make the quality look good and really try to inspire salespeople or inspire the audience. And of course, as television progressed, as television changed, as resolutions got higher, as the image got better, as we introduced color to films, they wanted to make things look better on television as well.
Well, you have that the presentation of film you're talking about for Budweiser. That was one narrated by Ed McMahon, who was the spokesperson for many, many years for Bud.
Certainly. And, of course, he was basically the voice for Budweiser. And I think, that's about association. You know, people that people recognize that they associate with. And this was really trying to motivate the speakers and really address the campaign that they wanted the salespeople to be on the same page with them.
This, as I understand it, is a somewhat lengthy presentation. We don't have time for that. But we do have a Budweiser commercial, early vintage. And I think the audience listening will find it's quite different from what they have become used to over the years with Anheuser-Busch commercials. Anything to say about that before you play?
Yes. Well, this particular film in its entirety was very interesting in that it was short skits done by many of the character actors from the 1960s. Again, this is from 1966, and it was about the sales campaign. And this particular clip is animated, and it was a Saul Bass. If you remember who Saul Bass was, Saul Bass did, as now that we're in the holiday season, did the animatronic things, the stop-motion animation things like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but also did a lot of the graphics for intros to films where the credits for the film were displayed, and so Saul Bass was very prominent in that field, and I'm sure it was very expensive to have Saul Bass.
A lot of these, by the way, are viewable on YouTube. A lot of them are out there, and they've
certainly
been there. If people are interested in pursuing this subject, I can do that. Okay, let's give a listen to that Budweiser commercial you just mentioned.
The brewers of Budweiser have bought this time to make an announcement. We are convinced Budweiser is the finest tasting beer in the world. What we'd like to do is convince you. We only have time to make one of our many sales points, so we've chosen this one. Budweiser is the only beer in America that's beechwood aged, which is where its smoothness comes from. That's important. But, well, let's be blunt. Nothing will convince you like the beer itself. So,
snap the crown off a bottle of Bud and let that flavor out. Here's a beer that makes it mighty clear what taste is all about. So, raise your stein at the friendly sign, Budweiser, king of beers.
Well, there you have it. Not a Clydesdale in sight.
That's true, yes.
Yeah. But it's really interesting to listen to that and just remember how the Anheuser-Busch commercials have developed over the years, consistently winning all the awards, Super Bowl awards, for instance, that sort of thing.
It really is remarkable. And I think Budweiser was one of those corporations that really drove the advertising industry. They understood what was important about getting your name out there and getting it recognized. And that may be why Reichsbier is no longer around, is that it was difficult to compete with a corporation like that.
But what do any other corporations that advertised heavily come to mind that you've experienced in this collection?
Well, I think Brown Shoe was one that we talked about. I think Brown Shoe was very prominent, and some don't come to mind at this point. No.
God, I'm going way back. I'm Buster Brown. I live in a shoe. That's my dog, Tig. He lives in there with me too.
Again, that was very powerful. You still remember that, you know?
Well, what other elements do you want to talk about with regard to what you've discovered so far? We've got photography. The photography with those that I've seen is marginal. It's not certainly of the caliber that we're used to today.
That's true. So some of the other elements, I think that in regards to this collection or just in our collections in general?
Either way.
Well, I think that our collections are quite diverse as well. It's not only film that we have, but we have the radio advertisements from this collection. But we also have collections from – we have news collections. We have Charter Media is another donation that we have. They also produced a lot of commercials. But we're getting into the videotape era then. So we have a lot of original programming content from stations in the region. We also have things from KTVI. We have some things that feature you, of course. Back in the day, so
they've survived.
They have survived, and
oh my.
We have quite a diverse collection, and we're looking forward to really getting that out to people.
Well, it sounds wonderful. I can't wait until it's a little farther along. We can talk more about it as you discover more as this process takes place. When did you start? And 3 years from now, we're talking about 2020, I guess,
yes.
Or maybe even later than that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very exciting.
When did you start all this?
Well, we're just now starting.
Oh, it's,
so,
okay.
Yeah, so we are just now trying to really discover this collection. And, I think it's going to be a very exciting process. So we're really looking forward to it.
We are too. Thank you so much, Chris Martinez of the Missouri History Museum, for telling us about this. It's a lot of fun. And again, I'd recommend folks, if they're interested in these vintage commercials, go to YouTube and you'll find a whole bunch of them that are good for reminiscing and nostalgia, and also good for a laugh or two from time to time.
Certainly. Thanks a lot, Don.
Chris, thank you so much. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.